You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 22nd of July 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House here on Monocle 24, live from Studio One here in London with me, Emma Nelson and Phil Hahn.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we'll be setting the day's agenda with our Tokyo Bureau Chief, Fiona Wilson. Fiona, what do you have for us today?
Well, Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's ruling coalition has won a comfortable majority in important upper house elections. And Australia is implementing tough new policies on immigrants arriving by boat.
Thanks very much indeed, Fiona. And as Mali prepares to hold elections for the first time since the state of emergency was lifted, we get the latest from Bamako.
Plus,
the race has been a fight every single day, something different. Crosswinds, rain, mountains, good days in the mountains, bad days in the mountains.
Say Finney, Britain's Chris Froome has won the Tour de France.
Also ahead, we'll meet the man who's created rich orchestration and quirkily lyrical takes on the American dream.
Everything I do, whether it's being noticed or not being noticed, I put my entire heart into it.
All that plus, we'll check in with our man in Istanbul, we'll have a look at today's Italian front pages, and we may even play some music as well. That's all to come in the next hour here on Midori House. So, a very busy program up ahead, but before all that, here is David Spencer with the latest world news.
Phil, thank you. Monocle 24 News, I'm David Spencer. At least 47 people have been killed after a powerful earthquake hit China's northwest Gansu province. Hundreds more have been injured, according to officials, with the tremor causing landslides and flooding. The 6.6 magnitude quake hit near the city of Dingxi. In New Zealand, workers have been advised to stay away from Wellington's central business district as safety inspections are carried out after a strong earthquake on Sunday. Engineers are examining how much damage the 6.5 magnitude quake caused. Initial reports suggested only minor damage in and around Wellington, but New Zealand Prime Minister John Key says the public are still wary.
People have high levels of anxiety when they feel earthquakes. That's totally understandable. People feel helpless. They can't control the situation. And these aftershocks, as we know from Christchurch, roll on for a long period of time. So it's destabilising to people's confidence. But you know, I think they can take confidence from the fact that we do have a high standard of building code in Wellington and in New Zealand.
The Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe says his win in Sunday's upper house elections will help him form a stable cabinet. Local broadcasters suggest his ruling coalition won at least 76 of the 121 seats contested. That would mean he's the first Japanese Prime Minister to have control of both houses of parliament for 6 years. And Mr. Abe said he hoped it would end the political volatility. Monocle's Asia editor-at-large is Kenji Hall. He says Mr. Abe has three strands of economic policy that he's pushing.
So far, he's done the two easy parts, which are mostly sort of growth-boosting measures. The third is the hardest part, and that's raising taxes and getting the government's finances in order. Currently, Japan's debt is more than twice its GDP.
EU foreign ministers are due to meet to discuss calls to list the military wing of Lebanese militant group Hezbollah as a terrorist organisation. The move, which is being backed by the UK, requires the agreement of all the EU's 28 member states. If they agree, it will become illegal for Hezbollah sympathisers in Europe to send the group money or for European diplomats to meet its militant staff. Colombia's president has ordered the army not to stop shooting until the conflict with the FARC rebels is over. The comments from Juan Manuel Santos came after 15 soldiers died in an ambush on Saturday. He has also ordered more troops to the east of the country, where the attack by suspected FARC gunmen took place. The government has rejected a rebel call for a truce during the talks, claiming that would only give them the opportunity to regroup and rearm. Researchers say that logging in Africa's Congo Basin has fallen by a third since 2000. Two universities in the UK have looked at images taken from space of one of the world's largest rainforests. They say it looks far healthier than expected, and this could be because of a focus on mining and oil rather than commercial agriculture in the region, a practice that has seen vast swathes of the Amazon rainforest disappear. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thanks, David. David will be back in 25 minutes to bring us a quick roundup of what's happening around the world. In the meantime, though, you're with Midori House here on Monocle 24.
And welcome back. You're listening to Midori House, live from Studio One here in London with me, Phil Hahn, and Emma Nelson.
Time to set the day's agenda. Every day we tell you the three stories you need to keep in mind for the next 24 hours. Today we hear from our Tokyo Bureau Chief, Fiona Wilson. Fiona, welcome back to the programme. I think it's good that we start with the fallout or the next step following Shinzo Abe's LDP victory in role retaking of the upper house.
Yes, that's right. He won a very decisive victory. There were 120 seats up for grabs and he and his coalition partner won 76 of them. So, yeah, he's in a very good position now. He controls both chambers, which means that he can get the economic policies he wants into place. I mean, it's really about the rather unpopular structural reform, I think, at this point.
And this is the first time in 6 years that there, in fact, will be a stable government in Japan. The revolving door of prime ministers coming in and out seems to, at least for the meantime, be put to a stop. Do we expect that Shinzo Abe will be able to make decisions and things that he wants to see happen push through?
Well, you know, who knows in Japanese politics? As you're absolutely right, we've had so many prime ministers. I mean, there are no elections required legally until 2016 now. So, you know, in a way, he has carte blanche to do what he wants to do. Now, he and the other parties that favour constitutional reform didn't get the two-thirds majority they needed, although his party did very well. His partners on that particular project didn't do so well. So I think all the talk about constitutional change is a bit secondary to economic reform.
It seems a bit, it obviously would appear to be secondary, but there is there's a substantial amount of commentary at the moment saying that Abe obviously now has to push through this third arrow, the raising of taxes, the lowering of trade barriers. But it might be so difficult that he could divert his attention, perhaps unwisely, towards the nuclear programme, towards the constitution, in fact, anything but the economy.
Well, in fact, you know, at the moment, the economy is a thing he's safer on, safer than constitutional issues. I mean, if he touches on constitutional issues, he threatens to upset all Japan's neighbours. So I think he'd actually be wise to stick on the economy, which is the most buoyant bit of his policy at the moment. But it's interesting you talk about the constitution, because his coalition partner, which the new Komeito Party, which doesn't favour constitutional reform, has asked him not to go to Yasukuni Shrine, which is the very controversial shrine where the war dead are remembered.
And Fiona, back to the point about the economy and that being kind of Shinzo Abe's main focus right now, one of the things that he's floating is the idea to raise consumption tax from 5 to 8%. Still a very controversial idea. He's kind of currently polling around 60% approval ratings in Japan. If there's a sense that that approval rating will fall, is there a concern that people behind him in his party may potentially start to lose faith in him as a leader?
Well, that consumption tax policy is something he inherited. It's been talked about for a long, long time. The previous government, the DPJ, who did very badly in this election, they put that policy forward as well. It's basically been agreed by most people that Japan probably does need to raise its consumption tax. So it's been known about for a long time. It was always an issue. It was an issue in the election, that the general election where Shinzo Abe won very decisively. So I don't think that in itself will diminish his popularity.
What does the political landscape now look like in Japan, Fiona? I mean, we have the LDP, Shinzo Abe, and in conjunction with the new Komeito Party, in control of the upper house. You've just mentioned there that the DPJ, the Democrat, the DPJ have fallen to bits, effectively. There was this, always has been this two-party system between the LDP and the DPJ. Has the last few months just seen this fall to pieces, or is there what kind of restructuring is happening?
Well, I think basically the LDP, you know, much like the British Conservative Party, has just been the dominant force in politics since the war. There was a brief hiatus when the DPJ won a very, you know, significant election, and everyone was very delighted about that. But it really fell apart quite quickly in the aftermath of the tsunami and the Fukushima Daiichi disaster. A lot of people felt that the DPJ didn't handle things as well as they could. Who would have been wanted to be dealt with that hand? But they did make a lot of mistakes. Then policies just couldn't be put through, and it just fell apart towards the end of last year. So it's pretty much time for the DPJ to regroup and think about where it wants to head. I mean, many of its members come from different parties, and who knows what the future is for that party.
And Fiona, let's move on to now the second story that you've highlighted for us. Of course, here in the UK, we continue the debate over our relationship with the European Union, but now Japan's getting involved as well.
Well, this was such a fascinating story to me. So the Sunday Times played this story rather large yesterday, and it sort of implied, you know, that it had some leaked document, which in fact was just a very boring document put up on the Japanese embassy in the UK on their website on the 15th of July. So it'd been up for days, and it was a rather sort of simple answer to a series of questions that the British government had put out to presumably to many embassies, saying, what would you think if if Britain left the EU? And Japan, perhaps naively, posted its answer. And this has been picked up as a sort of outrageous bit of interference by the Japanese government, which I think might surprise the foreign ministry in Japan. I don't think that was the intention. And actually, when I read it to see what was said, and it says absolutely at the top, you know, this is a decision for the UK people and Parliament. So I think it's been overplayed. But today it's in all the British papers. It's been all over the wires. It's made the Japanese papers. I think the reaction has made the Japanese papers. So it's an interesting media story as much as anything.
It is an interesting media story. The hook on this story was the risk of jobs in the United Kingdom were this to happen, that there was a threat that Japanese companies might pull out of the United Kingdom if the UK were to pull out of the EU. I mean, the UK would obviously have bigger things to worry about than some jobs from Japanese investments. But how much does the United Kingdom and Japan still rely on each other as a sort of, not only in trade, but as a conduit into Europe?
I think they have a very, very strong relationship. There's a long-standing historical, there's a good relationship there. And I feel that, you know, Japan thinks of the UK as a country it can really do business with. And as it mentioned in this response, it says that, you know, 130,000 jobs have been created by Japanese companies. There are over 1,300 Japanese companies invested in the UK. I think what the Sunday Times did was elide a few different statements, comments in a very short piece, and come up with the conclusion that Japan was saying all that would be lost if the UK left the EU, which wasn't exactly what it was saying. It was saying that it supported the single market.
And Fiona, moving on to your third story, which has really, I think, captured not only the attention of people in Australia, where the story is from, but also around the world. Of course, Prime Minister Kevin Rudd announcing a new policy on asylum seekers, saying that anyone that comes to Australia illegally will be turned away and sent back to Papua New Guinea. Quite a startling turn of events for that Prime Minister, especially considering he is a more centre-left Prime Minister. What's the reaction been like in Japan?
Well, I don't know. It's only just filtering through this news. I mean, in the Australian papers, there were very large adverts put out by the government this weekend saying, don't bother coming here, you won't get a visa. It's aimed particularly, specifically at people arriving by boat. There have been a lot of tragic cases of people drowning on their way to Australia, often via Indonesia. Even in the last few days, 5 people since July the 12th. So it's a big problem for Australia. It's a very, very tough policy. And it's interesting that Tony Abbott, who's the opposition leader, very outspoken, said this policy is held together with blue tack and sticky tape, you know, typical frank-speaking Tony Abbott. I mean, his point was that if you look closely at the what's been agreed, it doesn't absolutely ensure that everyone who wants to go to Australia won't be able to go to Australia. So it's not quite as definitive. I think the idea is to have a big publicity blitz which deters people from coming. I think that's the main point.
Fascinating stuff. You know, and our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, wrote a nice monologue about this very topic today. And you can catch that on our website, monocle.com, or, of course, listen to The Globalist Asia this evening at 2000 hours London time as well. But we're going to have to leave it there. Fiona Wilson, our Tokyo Bureau Chief, many thanks.
Steve making the
culture on Monocle 24 is untouchable. Go on, just try and do it. Try and grab a handful of the top-grade cultural radio that we're dishing out and see if you can touch it. Well, exactly. Luckily, though, you can feel it. Feel the passion of the unusually button-bright presentation.
It's a fantastic contrast, and it's one of those ones that ask you to look at the brushwork, to look just at the canvas.
Feel the craftsmanship in the breathtaking live Midori House sessions.
You know, I consider myself an entertainer, so I'm really about communication. I'm not really about expressing myself so much as trying to communicate with people and bring them to tears or bring them to laughter or what have you.
Feel the lovingly hand-stitched production, and most of all, feel the love of art.
It's there, and it's true, but it's really only a small part of his work.
Feel the love of fiction, feel the love of film, feel the love of music, feel the love, generally.
It is the most extraordinary collation of works that you would never normally see together.
Why not invite me round? Culture with Robert Bound is a well-behaved house guest and a joy to entertain.
That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House with Phil Hahn and Emma Nelson. In a moment, well, we'll tell you what it's all about. You'll be able to guess from this. This is from 1983, Kraftwerk and Tour de France.
Yes, the 100th Tour de France finished on Sunday with a British rider victorious for the second year running. Chris Froome crossed the line on the Champs-Élysées a full 4 minutes ahead of the rest of the peloton.
It's the first tour since Lance Armstrong admitted to doping during his 7 victories, so has the reputation of this year's competition been reclaimed by good, clean, old-fashioned sportsmanship? We're on the line with Geoffrey Wheatcroft, the journalist, author of Le Tour, A History of the Tour de France, and general tour aficionado. Geoffrey, are you nursing a sore head today?
No, I mean, I don't think that the Sky team will be. they train very hard and they are extremely abstemious during the race. But when they've won a victory like the one they won last night, they are entitled to, and indeed do, go out and open a few bottles.
Absolutely. And as we were hearing, his team finishing a full 4 minutes ahead of the rest of the pack. You were covering this tour this year. Did you find that the cyclists were perhaps more willing to take risks than they were in other years?
Well, it's been a very good tour. I mean, judging not just leaving aside the result, it's been an extremely exciting race. More so than last year's, actually, when Bradley Wiggins won, which was slightly clinical, and it was very cleverly won by Sky and Wiggins. But this year, people then were complaining a year ago that nobody had had a go. There hadn't been any great attacks over the mountains and so forth. Well, you couldn't possibly claim that this year. There were some immensely exciting and dramatic and competitive racing in the Pyrenees, where Froome won a brilliant victory. But after his own Sky team had rather fallen away behind him, there were thrills and spills throughout the race, and in the end a really famous victory for a brilliant cyclist.
What I always find strange about the Tour de France is that you have these, like you say, thrills and spills, but the margin of gains and losses in terms of winning and losing are minuscule.
Well, yes, you can race for 3 weeks, and at the end, one man will beat another by 8 seconds, as happened with Fignon once, 30 years ago. This time was rather touching. Froome had a 5-minute lead in the general classification, the yellow jersey, but he lost a minute yesterday, something that very rarely happens, simply because he fell back in the final stage on the Champs-Élysées, so that he could link arms with his Sky team and that they could ceremonially cross the line together. They are a good team, and that is real team spirit for you.
And Chris Froome and his team, they actually preemptively released data for his past 2 years of climbs, I believe. Do you think that will put an end to any kind of discussion or debate about whether or not there was any doping involved this year?
No, it won't put an end to it, because nothing is ever going to put an end to it. After what we've been through, after the revelations of the last year, after it has sunk in us that the Lance Armstrong affair was, I think, the worst single scandal in the whole history of competitive sport. it is going to be a very long time before cycling can completely shake off those dark shadows left by the appalling Armstrong. But Chris Froome and Dave Brailsford, his manager, and Sky are making a very effective fight back on this. They brought David Walsh, who was the Sunday Times journalist who exposed Lance Armstrong, into them. He was embedded with the Sky team. He had complete access to them. And at the same time, Equipe, the French paper, which harried and derided Armstrong from early on, saying that he was riding on another planet, which was a heavy hint as to what they thought he was doing, were provided with a great deal of the clinical data about Froome, which analysts can then look at, and indeed they have done. And he's been given a clean bill of health. All of the experts who analyze things like wattage and power-to-energy ratio and hemocrit levels. I won't take up too much time explaining what all of those are, but these are the telltale signs that someone is doping. They've now been examined in very thoroughly by detached observers, and there is a general change in opinion and the feeling now that Froome really is establishing that he is definitely clean and that bike racing itself is getting much cleaner.
Jeffrey, you talk about dark shadows over cycling. Do you think that cycling in the Tour de France will ever be able to fully recover its reputation that it once had?
Well, it won't happen overnight. I mean, how can it when I've just said that it was the worst scandal in the history of competitive sport? But, I mean, all you can do and all Chris Froome and Dave Brailsford and Sky are doing is to be as honest as possible and hope that honesty is the best policy. They are being completely open, which, of course, the U.S. postal team under Armstrong never were. They were very secretive indeed, for good reason. And they can just go on and on. And I think that they will gradually win the argument. That is my hope, at any rate.
Jeffrey Wheatcroft, it has been a pleasure to follow the Tour de France with you. Thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Vanuit Londen. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, eu sou London. This is Monocle 24.
Ot London, tu é Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London. London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London. London.
This is Monocle 24.
And welcome back. You're with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Phil Hahn, and Emma Nelson. Now, Van Dyke Parks is the musician, lyricist, and producer who, since the 1960s, has worked with everyone, artists as diverse as Joanna Newsom to the Beach Boys.
Parks recently released his first new album in 18 years. It's called Songs Cycled. He stopped by Midori House and sat down with Tom Hall to talk about it for this week's edition of Culture.
I was 24 when I made Songs Cycle. I'm now 70, and this is Songs Cycled. And yeah, sure, it reflects on that, but that wasn't what I was driven to do. Although I'd like to always go out the way I came in, that isn't a physical possibility. It is musically what I'd like to do.
Just starting back at Songs Cycle, when I hear that record, it seems to be not only an attempt to distill much of American life, but to me it feels like a bit of a microcosm of Los Angeles itself. There's a lot of locations, you know, such as Laurel Canyon and Vine Street mentioned in it, whereas the new record, as far as I gather, it touches on things as diverse as 9/11 and the Prestige oil spill I saw. When you were making that record back in the 60s, were you still trying to say something about the wider world? Or
No. It's very simple. In Literature 101, when I went to school and they were talking about writing, the rule one is write what you know. So there's no conscious attempt at being autobiographical. But in fact, every work is inescapably autobiographical. This is who I am. I am 9/11. I am oil spills. I am eco-catastrophe. I am deeply happy but darkly informed. Song's cycle reflects that. It's wrapped in a very attractive, seductive cover, but that is really a coating to protect the casual observer from the darkness that lies within, which is basically, unintentionally, a caution to youth. Constant commentary by the wayside. Nowadays, them country boys don't cotton much to 1, 2, 3, 4 kid.
More recently, you've collaborated and produced for the likes of Joanna Newsom and, you know, in the past, Rykuda and people like that. I mean, you're very much known, I think, as a collaborator. When you make a record like this, is that a feeling of sort of shaking off that tag a bit? Because you have your own voice. You don't want to be just known as that guy who makes things happen and makes things work. Is that something you feel?
It is liberating in a way, and also frightening, to be the voice. It's much easier to be behind the curtain, and that's where I usually am. Being noticed brings great risk. And that comes with the dinner with this. But at the same time, I think doing a record, doing an album, and these songs, in spite of anybody's misgivings about their being in demo form and singles, and they were last year, I put them out as singles to get noticed. They're all entirely new as far as I'm concerned. Every time I perform them, there's a great sense of novelty. Every performance is orchestrated differently. There's a lot of handiwork in what I do. It's not just by the seat of the pants. It's both seat of the pants and a core, a heartfelt endeavor. Everything I do, whether it's being noticed or not being noticed, I put my entire heart into it. It's life-defining, working for Joanna Newsom, Rufus Wainwright, Scissor Sisters, U2, I mean, Natalie Cole, Randy Newman.
I wanted to actually know the record, the infamous record, Smile, because you collaborated with Brian on the finished version, which came out about 5 or 6 years ago.
Yes.
How do you feel about the version of Smiley Smile, the original kind of half finished, kind of almost slightly frowned upon by, I think, the Beach Boys? Is that right?
I mean, I didn't listen to it.
You didn't hear it?
No, and I don't really. You might think that this is highfalutin kind of an arrogant remark or flip. But I don't listen to what I've done. I enjoy doing it. My heart is in the work. Everything else is beyond my control. What people might say. I'm not daunted by flattery. I'm still alive. I've faced some Job-like adversity from press that couldn't easily compartmentalize my work. I'm just another guy who's doing music. And I tell you, there's something that really dogs me about this whole thing about infamous music or famous music. It's music. It's not munitions. Why should we say that we don't like Andrew Lloyd Webber? The guy is not making bombs. So I think that we must forgive musicians. I think I have every right to make these public declarations and records. And I'm proud of them all. I've been very fortunate. The work I did for Brian Wilson, for example, man, am I lucky that it came out at all. I'm so fortunate. There's so many people of superior ability never get to hear a note. So I was lucky to meet Brian Wilson. In the long run, it turned out to be, although not the big hits that I had hoped for, I wanted to write Help Me, Rhonda. I really did want to write those lyrics. But those melodies weren't there. It was a different item. He was in pursuit of something else. He wanted out of the box, and I had a key.
Song Cycled is an album that you can very, I guess, firmly say that you've finished, wrapped up, and it's ready for everyone to hear, right?
I think it's music for our time and of our time, and I think that it speaks to things that matter. But it is, I think it's a terrific entertainment. And I think it's beautiful.
And you can hear much more like that at 1900 hours London time in this week's edition of Culture.
You're listening to Midori House. In a moment, we'll discuss the upcoming elections in Mali. We'll check in with our man in Istanbul. And we'll also review this morning's Italian front pages. But before all that, here is Mr. Spencer with the latest world news.
At least 47 people have been killed after a powerful earthquake hit China's northwest Gansu province. Hundreds more have been injured, according to officials, with the 6.6 magnitude tremor causing landslides and flooding. Japan's Prime Minister Shinzo Abe has won control of both houses of his parliament after victory in upper house elections on Sunday. He's the first Japanese Prime Minister to have control of both houses of parliament for 6 years. EU foreign ministers are due to meet to discuss calls to list the military wing of Lebanese militant group Hezbollah as a terrorist organisation. The move, which is being backed by the UK, requires the agreement of all the EU's 28 member states. Colombia's president has ordered the army not to stop shooting until the conflict with the FARC rebels is over. The comments from Juan Manuel Santos came after 15 soldiers died in an ambush on Saturday. Australian Prime Minister Kevin Rudd says he makes no apology for his country's new asylum policy. Under an agreement signed on Friday, asylum seekers arriving by boat in Australia will be sent to Papua New Guinea for processing, sparking criticism that the country is outsourcing its problem to a developing nation. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, David. David will be back at the top of the hour with another check of the world news. It is 8:32 here in London. That makes it 7:32 in Bamako, where we're going to be heading over to now. The run-up to this week's vote in Mali have not gone very well. Over the weekend, four election workers and a deputy mayor were kidnapped. They were later released by the Tuareg separatist group, the MNLA. An unexploded bomb was also found in the northern town of Kidal, and four people died last week in violence in Kidal between Tuaregs and black civilians.
Nonetheless, as enormous pressure for these elections to go ahead, not least because of the huge international effort earlier this year to drive out Islamist rebels who'd seized parts of the north of the country. Well, we're joined in the studio by Akli Shaka Baisad, who's a Tuareg activist, and we're also joined on the line from Bamako by Monocle's woman there, Alex Duval-Smith. Welcome to the programme, both of you. Alex, we'll start with you. As Phil just mentioned there was a kidnapping this weekend, which has dominated the headlines and has pretty much given an indication of how unstable things are in the run-up to the elections?
Well, certainly given an indication of the danger and the election as it could go, as it were, at its worst, because it's raised fears that given the insecurity that still exists in the north of the country, not only is it too dangerous to hold an election, but even if real sort of bombs and suicide bombings aren't happening, then people simply will be too afraid to go out and vote. And the problem in the north of Mali is that not only is the security situation difficult at the moment, but a large part of the population has become displaced or gone into refugee camps, which means that the voice of the north is very unlikely to be heard in these elections. Already Mali has a record of low turnouts in elections, so there's a danger that it's going to be a southern election. It's going to be southerners electing the president of the whole country.
Well, actually, we heard there from our woman in Bamako, Alex, the Tuareg separatist group, the MLNA, behind those kidnappings this weekend. Why are they using these tactics when there's an election so soon?
Well, I'm not sure because I've been in touch with some people in the north of Kidal, exactly in Kidal. It's these people who have been kidnapped are not from the MNLA. As you know, there's a lot of different groups acting in the area, Ansar al-Din and also the MMA. The fighting actually has been taking place between the MNLA and the other group belonging to the Arab population in the north of Mali. As your reporter said, actually, yes, there is a lot of problems actually standing or facing the people in Mali, particularly in the north. As you know, 70% of the population in the north have been displaced, and most of them are in the camps, and also they refuse totally to go to cast their votes because, as you know, the Tuareg and the Arabs in the north have faced a lot of massacres against them. So they're saying, how are we going to vote for the killers who actually destroyed our houses and killed our children, our elderly. So it's a long way. I don't think these elections actually is going to head, or even if they are going to head, it's not going to be in the north, because the north actually is, even if it's not recognized by international or the regional countries, now the north is totally split up from the south. And also a lot of problems coming as well from Bamako. As all we know, there's a division between Sanogo's men, the guy who led the coup, and also for people who want to go ahead with elections, because this guy actually does not want these elections to go ahead so he can stay in power.
Actually, you paint a portrait there of a country which seems to be no further on than it was when there was a state of emergency a few months ago, when the UN forces came in, the French have been on the ground. What is it, or why do you think they're holding elections now?
It is ridiculous, actually. Nobody, at this situation, I think this is all actually the international community, particularly France, because it's France needs to show that has succeeded in this operation. But to be honest, I don't think this is just political agenda for France and other countries who want to say, oh, we have an election now and everything is okay. But the main problem, which exists for 53 years now, is too far to be from being solved, because the main problem is the Tuareg, who have been fighting for almost half a century now for their rights, but they are pushed away from all France. As well we know, France, when it came to the north in 1963, that country actually was totally independent from the south, but pushes away the Tuareg, and now the Tuaregs and the Arabs are actually accusing them of France is coming back again after we had declared our independence and everything, and now giving our land back to the Malians again.
How do you go about claiming independence when you consider yourselves a nomadic group?
Well, nomadic in terms of nomadism, yes, we're indigenous people of North Africa, and we have been invaded by many nations, but originally this land actually is ours. I don't think the nomadism actually preventing us, because we have faced a lot of massacres, racism, discrimination, not only in Mali, but also in Algeria and Libya and Niger. And this is the main problem. The international is still ignoring the main problem of the Tuareg people to have their own rights. And this is the right of every nation to have their self-determination.
Alex, let's come to you there in Bamako. As we heard, Akli said these elections are absolutely ridiculous. Do you agree with that statement? And on the streets of Bamako, are citizens there, are they viewing this election as being ridiculous?
Well, Mali, I think, as I mentioned, had a history of very low turnouts and quite a lot of cynicism in terms of the electoral process, because it has been so corrupt over the years. And in Bamako, there's not enormous enthusiasm. There's sort of a view that they're always bad and these will be another set of bad elections, and people might want to take part, feeling that it's the one sort of choice option they have to help Mali to move on, to open a new chapter in the country's history. I mean, that's pretty much what France and the international community are telling Malians. And of course, they're putting a lot of money into this. I wanted to address a couple of the things that you raised. I think the reason these elections are going ahead is pretty much, as you say, that it's pressure from the international community, not just France, but also the United States, because the United States, under American laws, cannot engage with a country that has a military regime or a transitional regime as a result of a military coup, which is currently Mali's position. And the United States is footing the bill for MINUSMA, the 12,000 strong United Nations force, very keen to come in strategically into Mali. Also, if you don't mind, I wanted to turn to, I do think it's an interesting but entirely contradictory argument to say that a nomadic people have a right to fight for land. I mean, by nature, a nomadic people are nomadic and don't have a nation state. The Sahara does give the Tuareg a great deal of freedom to move and a great deal of latitude to function in their traditional trades. Now, the picture of the MNLA from Bamako, I think it's important to say, is very, very hostile. If I can give you an idea, the picture of the MNLA is that it's a small feudal family group representing a very tiny percentage of the Tuareg people, and there's enormous hostility to the MNLA here. It's very, very hard to imagine the MNLA and the Bamako government having any kind of agreement on any issue.
Actually, what would you say to that, the idea that the MNLA are despised in Bamako, and therefore any kind of efforts to be brought into the democratic process is just not going to happen because they are outlawed?
I think that's very natural, because it's, whenever you have your enemy, you know to tarnish its reputation and everything. But if we come to the international, especially the Amnesty International and the human rights organizations who've been reporting from us, we know all what Mali massacre killings and have done against the Tuareg people, and but we have not heard about a single man who has been killed because of his race or because of the MNLA or other movements in the area. That's very natural, because Mali actually, this problem is not something new. It goes back for half a century now, and the Tuareg have been, each time they raise against the government, they face massacres and killings, and that's what's happening. And now 70% of the population of the Tuareg people, or even 99% to be honest, are now away, displaced. They are no longer staying in the areas where the Mali are actually taking control, like Kidal and Timbuktu and other areas. And French also has, you know, a heavy hand and responsibility, because it's watching what the Malian army doing against the civilians, the armless people, but doing nothing, just watching. And this is actually a shame, to be honest, on the French and the international community. Particularly, we have seen a lot of declarations was coming from the international community, like human rights, that have been done. Yeah.
Akhli Shaka Baisad, thank you very much indeed for coming into the studio. And in Bamako, our thanks to Alex Duval-Smith. You're listening to Midori House.
Aspiring for greener cities and easier commutes, more and more people are switching to bikes. From Zurich to Toronto and onto Buenos Aires, we film pedal makers who've opened up artisanal bike shops to provide bespoke services for two-wheeled enthusiasts.
Frames are recycled and reworked, featuring Monochrome's minimalist design aesthetic. This bespoke upcycling has turned them into one of the Argentinian capital's greenest takes on transport.
Bike shops with a difference. In the film's menu on monocle.com.
It's 10:43 a.m. in Ankara, 8:43 a.m. here in London. We head to Turkey.
Joining us on the line from Istanbul is our man there, Caleb Lauer. Caleb, thanks very much for joining us here on Midori House. Shall we talk about some upcoming elections, perhaps?
Well, sure. The first thing that should be said about the topic of elections in Turkey is that we are entering an election season that promises to be very, very long, probably brutal as far as electoral politics go, and extremely consequential. This is something that is going to, without exaggerating too much, it will really fundamentally reshape the future trajectory of Turkey. There's local elections coming up, there's presidential elections coming up, there's parliamentary elections coming up, and then there is a potential vote on a new constitution. Now, just to give you a sense of how long or extended this season promises to be, today we're talking, it's July 2013. The first of these elections isn't going to be held until March 2014. That's 8 months away. But still, the discussion programs, the newspapers, the comment sections of everything are about these elections that are coming up. So the election season has started. And it's going to be, it's not just going to be a few weeks or a month, as you have in the UK. It's going to be something like an American election season, which is years long. One of the key things that have come out of this, or with regards to this topic, is a recent poll that has shown that the AK Party, the governing party, the AK Party, has lost quite a bit of support over the last year. In February 2012, they had a support rate of 53%. As of today, it's 44%. So they've dropped quite a bit.
This drop, it's been a very, very tough few months for Erdogan and the AK Party, hasn't it? That he's not only had to face public protests, which have been done nothing for Turkey's soft power image across the world. He's also had to deal with the PKK and the attempts to resolve the Kurdish issue.
Yeah, this is what is very, very important to note about these poll figures, is that from this drop, almost a 10% drop since February 2012, people will assume that this must be about the Taksim Square protests or the Gezi Park protests, which saw, you know, huge international condemnation in terms of police brutality, et cetera, and huge amounts of domestic condemnation in terms of police brutality. But what's interesting to note is that the poll figures for April 2013, which was just a few months ago, but significantly before the Gezi Park protests happened, was only a point higher than it is today, which shows that the Gezi Park protests and the Taksim protests only lost the party 1% of its total domestic support. And this indicates two things. Like you said, the main reason that the party is losing support is because of its constituents' view of its attempt to make peace with the PKK, which is still very, very controversial.
Caleb, let's move to mayoral elections there in Istanbul. Two names that you've highlighted, which actually are quite surprising. We have Egemen Bajis, who's currently the EU minister, and there's also Siri Undur, who during the protests we recognize he was one of the leading figures. He was there in parliament showing bruises from tear gas canisters being thrown at him. It's kind of being billed as a matchup between two giant superstars of Turkish politics.
That's right. And, you know, in that list of elections that are coming up, you know, parliamentary, presidential, a new constitution, the local elections may seem to be slightly less of a dramatic election. But it should be understood that this might be the most consequential of all the elections. The race for mayor of Istanbul is going to be not only is it the first election that's coming up out of that sequence of elections, it could be the most consequential. As many people will know, the AK Party is a coalition of various factions of the conservative Islamic right. If the AK Party was to lose the mayorship of Istanbul, this many people assume that this will be the first sort of real visible sign of cracks that people are already talking about in the party. Now, Egemen Bajis is rumored to be the candidate for the AK Party, and he's been the minister for EU negotiations. As many people know, he's a very, very flamboyant character. He's very, very outspoken. And during the protests of the last few months, he has been very controversial and combative in terms of his statements with regards to the protesters, which shows him to be very much a man of Erdogan and somebody that is very, very ready to position himself using the same rhetoric that Erdogan has been showing in the last few months. His likely opponent, or the rumored opponent, is Siri Undur, who has emerged as one of the sort of the key figures of the Gezi Park protest. He's already a member of parliament. He was injured during the protest. And he has a very, very wide support base. He's a film director, which makes him a bit of a celebrity in his own right. And he's not Kurdish either, which is quite interesting. He's a member of the Kurdish party, but he himself is a Turk. And recently we've seen him sort of broadening his rhetoric. So the election is not only significant in terms of does the AK Party win or not? The mayor of Istanbul the future mayor of Istanbul could be a very, very interesting person.
Caleb, we're going to have to leave it there. It looks like it's you're in for a very long election season there in Turkey. Caleb Lauer, our man in Istanbul, many thanks.
From London
to New York
to Hong Kong
to Shanghai
to Jakarta
to Moscow
to Los Angeles
to Beijing,
to Yokohama,
to Amsterdam,
to Cairo,
to Karachi,
to Bogota, all around the world. This is Monocle 24.
In a moment, we'll leaf through the Italian newspapers with our man David Pleasant. But before that, to take us there, here's Bastille with Pompeii.
Yeah.
And that was Bastille there with Pompeii.
You're with Midori House with me, Emma Nelson, and David Pleasant. He's brought
and
in
me.
The Italian...
And Phil Hahn. Oh, I'm yeah. here too.
And Phil Hahn. Phil Hahn.
Well, it's our time now to look through the Italian front pages. David, welcome to the studio. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Well, shall we? Where shall we begin today?
Well, we'll start with the front page of La Repubblica that is leading with this row that's emerging between the centre-left and the centre-right, PD and the PDL parties, as you all know now, after all these weeks of me telling you about this. The main row is now over the anti-homophobia legislation that the centre-left, the PD, is trying to bring in. The PDL, the centre-right, is saying that there's more important things at the moment than ethical legislation. So let's have a moratorium on ethical themes, they say. We need more concentration on the economic situation in the country. So they're kind of backlashing against... there's been a whole series of kind of this ethical, more inclusive kind of society that the PD is trying to come out with, and the PD is now... the centre-left is now... centre-right is now kind of backlashing.
It sounds confusing, but yeah. I get what you mean. The whole thing, though, I think you're quite right in mentioning the fact that they want to focus on the economy, because we were quite surprised when you came down and you said we want to talk about anti-homophobic legislation. And we thought... Sorry, why is this an important issue? And you've just lifted it up. It is the front page of La Repubblica.
Yeah, it is. And interestingly, and this is quite... It's nice when newspapers are not all leading with the same thing. This is very much a La Repubblica lead. The other papers, it's way down the headlines. But this is... I mean, it is quite an important issue. But I don't think it's probably a timely one for Italy. Often these ethical debates do get kind of swallowed up in all the kind of machinations of the whole political system. So it's quite interesting that the kind of left-leaning side of things are really taking this issue to cause.
And do you think that's an argument that's resonating with the Italian public, that they think the economy should be top of the mind, and those debates about ethical debates on certain issues should perhaps... Go to the back a bit.
Well, I don't think so, because if we're honest, if we look at the kind of situation of the last few years, if that was the case, then there probably wouldn't be any kind of legislation whatsoever apart from kind of economic considerations. So I think certainly people within the centre left are starting to think that we have to get on and pass these kind of measures despite this difficult situation economically. I think that's kind of the theme of the debate.
And David, another story which you've got, here at Monocle, we don't mind coming into work on Monday. But apparently it seems some doctors in Italy do.
Yeah, this is a story that they're calling it Inconvenient or Difficult Monday. The Corriere della Sera has got a big piece on the fact that a lot of doctors in Italy are going on strike today. That's so over 100,000 doctors are actually on strike this morning.
Wow. What are they striking about? Because they do strike quite a lot, do Italian doctors. I think they've done it in 2004, they did it in 2012. Why? What are they up to?
Well, it's over the contracts. The terms of their contracts are being changed. And I think what's happening within the medical system is that kind of shift towards what's happened in education, where people on these kind of seemingly unstable contracts. So they're feeling that their jobs are more precarious and they could be kind of shifted around hospitals and shifted around towns and cities in a way that has happened to school teachers. And school teachers in Italy are really kind of feeling the pinch of government cuts.
Has there been a backlash towards the doctors going on strike, or do you think the Italian public are kind of on their side and they can understand where they're coming from?
Well, I guess it affects so many people, and I guess many people have doctors in their families and so on, so probably are sympathetic to their cause. And you've got to remember, in Italy, well, like in many places, being a doctor is still thought of as a very kind of prestigious career. So there's probably still a bit of kind of respect for the family doctor. So
finally, David, horrible news odd news. Pesto in Liguria is full of Botox.
Yeah, really strange story here. Of course, Liguria is the region famous for its pesto. So a factory there has been found to have been leaking a type of Botox into jarred pesto. Wow. This is actually
quite... workers? What's happening? Where's it coming from? Well, obviously, they want to find out.
Well, Botox is an industrial product used for other things apart from plastic surgery and kind of rejuvenation of women of a certain age's faces. But so they're not quite sure where it's coming from. But it's quite a serious story. There's two people quite critically ill, two children, and also 30 people are in hospital. So it's serious stuff, and obviously affecting Liguria very, you know, people are very concerned. There's panic, apparently.
Well, David, we're going to have to leave it there. David Pleasant, many thanks for flicking through this morning's Italian front pages.
That's all we have time for today's programme. Our thanks to our producer, Barbara Frini, our researchers, Fernanda, Augusta Pacheco and Zoe Tennant, and to our studio manager, too, Alex Fennell. Up next, after the news, is The Urbanist.
And I'll be back with Dominic Reynolds for Midori House at the same time tomorrow. But for now, from me, Phil Hahn.
And me, Emma Nelson. It's goodbye and thank you very much for listening.
Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.